The first sister is a sister who has been in the struggle for almost 8 decades. She has a long-term history in New York, not only in her younger years, but those of you who are active in the struggles in New York are likely to recognize her. If there's a picket line, Vicky's likely to be there. If there's a meeting to clarify issues and debate, Vicky's likely to be there. If there is a conference on Malcolm X and the opening plenary is Sisters Remember Malcolm, Vicky is likely to be there. A long-term friend and a person that I'm sure you'll appreciate hearing from, who knew Malcolm in many stages of his life, I'd like now to introduce to you and to share with you Vicky Garvin.
I'm honored to have the opportunity to speak here again on the significance of Malcolm X, his role, and contribution, and his world outlook. When I first read the program, I noticed it said Malcolm X and a legacy to be transformed. And that upset me very much because I didn't see what I thought it meant, that we should transform his legacy. And so I came here really prepared for a fight. This was going to be a battle if somebody had that kind of interpretation. But I understand that that was not what was meant. Because I was prepared to say that if there's going to be anything about a legacy of Malcolm, it's a legacy to be transmitted, not one to be transformed. So I was prepared for that kind of orientation. But in saying this, and I know that there are people among us, perhaps none who are present here today, who says, well, you know, why should you accept Malcolm? You know, where did this, all of this information drop from? And why are you just, you know, making a god out of him? And why can't people discuss things? Well, and I'm sure all of us will say, that we do not preclude an analysis of what Malcolm's legacy is. But my position still is that it should read a legacy to be transmitted. Now, this does not imply that anyone is entitled to a blank check. Nothing should be designated as static dogma. I don't care who it may be. No one has a monopoly on knowledge and theories, nor does anyone have immunity from criticism. No one has a fail-proof blueprint for the road, a rough road, a winding one, to reach success. Malcolm didn't write the first word about struggle. He certainly wouldn't be the last. But I am here to attest that Malcolm added a big headlight to the roadmap. Now, at all crossroads and turning points, time out is necessary to determine what lies ahead. But if we have arrived safely and intact where and whenever we pause, we cannot discard the guidance we followed to a given point. Among Malcolm's attributes which remain are his unwavering dedication, integrity, the clarity of his African identity, his working class origin, and orientation. The fact that he built and relied upon his base, and it is one that is still in existence and even growing 25 years after his death. Malcolm's guidelines were developed through intensive study an experience. Malcolm was not an armchair general, nor an ivory tower theoretician. We've got a lot of those folks around. He thoroughly understood the nature of the system, and he had no illusions about its politicians or any faith that beyond getting a few crumbs occasionally, that integration or tokenism was not the solution to our problems. His tools were agitation, education, and organization, not rhetoric or charisma. He had all of that too, especially charisma. Malcolm had the guts to tell it like it is, forcibly and without fear, and he steadfastly defended his convictions. It took a lot of guts at the height of national mourning following the assassination of President Kennedy for Malcolm to publicly express his opinion that the chickens had come home to roost and to propagate our right to challenge the status quo by any means necessary. These are very fighting words to people who are trying to crush you. But Malcolm told it like it is. And the statement, by any means necessary, has become the cry and the slogan of all revolutionaries. Malcolm rejected the view that the talented 10th were the mainstay for progress. Dr. Du Bois himself later repudiated this terminology. Malcolm had his eyes on the masses under duress, with nothing to lose but their chains. And a college degree was not a prerequisite for leadership. Now, this is not anti-education, but people who get degrees, I don't care where it is, cannot automatically assume that they occupy the chair and got all the answers. Last year, I participated here in a panel on Malcolm in Ghana. My early introduction to Malcolm was when he worked as a hip, jovial bartender at Small's Paradise in Harlem, and later as a dynamic orator on the street corners when he addressed crowds of ordinary rank-and-file people about the evils perpetuated upon us by the white devils. As it happened, I was living and working in Ghana when he arrived. I went to Africa for sustenance and inspiration. Now that at that time several countries were winning their independence from colonial rule. For some time I'd been very despondent and demoralized, having experienced in the late 1940s the sellout of the workers when the CIO expelled 11 progressive trade unions. This was in collaboration, of course, with the reactionary policies of big business of the U.S. government. And I witnessed the turmoil that followed as workers tried to preserve their hard-won union gains. That might sound a little familiar to those of you who are working or read about what's happening in the U.S. today. The trade unions are at the lowest level of organization. There are very few that are waging any serious struggles. A lot of the leadership of unions are there on a lifetime basis. They made sweetheart contracts, have tremendous salaries. They're not interested in what's happening. It's a pretty rough situation, but it's not going to stay that way. The assault against the working class at that time was a precursor of the infamous McCarthy period, when the Cold War against the Soviet Union compacted upon the United States, and when anti-communist hysteria was unfurled and fanned throughout the country against all segments of society. Progressive individuals and organizations in particular, those who were fighting against what was incipient fascism. This was extended, this attack against progressive, as a battering rod against others under the facade of guilt by association. And this assault was harshly felt by African Americans. Anyone saw you in the company of anybody, or thought you got in the mail, or read in the newspapers, you were automatically called a communist, subversive, and possibly a traitor, lost your job. Some of you are not old enough to remember that period, but I lived through it. And Malcolm was no stranger to this development. So he had gone through a period also when he saw tremendous repression in the United States. I left New York City prior to the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, and so I had no opportunity to be infused with the spirit of our people who were on the offensive then. But I had been associated with Dr. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and Alpheus Hunton, who were the top leaders of the Council on African Affairs in the late 40s through a couple of decades. And so I was familiar with some of the struggles being waged by our African brothers and sisters. And I was so very pleased to see that Malcolm had moved beyond being a protagonist for justice for blacks in the United States. He had become an internationalist who recognized the commonality of the interests and destiny of Africa and its descendants in the diaspora. So I was very eager to join a committee that some of us living in Ghana at that time formed to assist Malcolm in making contact with important people there, including embassies of Cuba, China, and Algeria. Our committee escorted him to fairs that had not been scheduled by his official Ghanaian host. We were all very impressed by the large attendance that came to listen to him, the receptions he received everywhere, and how he conducted himself also. As an old trade unionist, I embraced Malcolm for a stand on the side of the laboring people. I knew we were on the same team. My last meeting with Malcolm was in Cairo, prior to my departure for China to become an English teacher for advanced students at the Shanghai Foreign Language Institute in Shanghai. Malcolm's parting words to me were, and I quote, "I'm glad you have a chance to see what this vast country has done to change the system. Learn what you can, tell them about us, but be sure to come back home to share your knowledge." I remembered this message when I decided in Shanghai that the term paper of my class would be "The History of the Negro People in the United States." We still call ourselves Negroes at that time. Each student was assigned to write a chapter dating from the slave era, which they subsequently presented for discussion to a large audience of Chinese teachers of English from many of the major cities. Now, I describe all of this as one illustration of Malcolm's impact upon me to try to find some way of making my international travels related to what we were doing at home. When I returned to the United States in 1970, I became aware of the influence Malcolm had had upon our youth. 20 years later, it is still operative, and indeed has mushroomed. We cannot accept the charge that the present generation is lost, hopeless, and irredeemable. Many of them have accepted Malcolm, sight unseen, as their leader, and are avidly studying his writings. They do need our encouragement, support, guidance, and love. In my opinion, the salient feature of Malcolm's life was his metamorphosis from a negative, self-destructive behavior and anti-socialist activity. He acknowledged all this in his autobiography, but he subsequently liberated himself into a responsible adult with firm manhood, self-respect, and self-love. But more importantly, having acquired a positive outlook for himself, he worked at instilling these values into others. This is a duty we must emulate today on a large scale to rescue those among our young people who are still prey to alienation, cynicism, apathy, and negative lifestyles. So in recognition of this phenomenon, if I didn't know Malcolm, it couldn't have come just out of my head. It had to come from my heart, my soul, and association. Another issue I would like to comment on as a black woman is sexism. Male supremacist ideology and practice have been a scourge throughout the ages, more pronounced in some countries than others. It is certainly much alive and far too well today in the United States. Our African-American women are still victims of sexism in many forms, not only in the workplaces, but in their homes and even within their families. And that includes some of ours as well. Sexism extends to relations, other relations, where women are in organizational association with men. Now, in raising this question, this is by no means narrow feminism, as we so often consider it when women begin talking about their rights for equality, dignity, respect. Nor is it a downgrading of the role and contributions of all male freedom fighters, past and present. Rather, it is a call to address this question, to stem the division between men and women. This is a non-antagonistic contradiction among us, and it can be resolved without warfare. This contradiction thwarts our unity and potential strength in what is a common battle against a common enemy. Our men must respect, support, and give due recognition to their female counterparts who have been and currently are on the firing line and on the scene as leaders, spokespersons, and organizers. We all acclaim Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, along with Frederick Douglass, annually during Black History Month. But it usually stops there. Now, time does not permit me to make a roll call of a lot of our unsung heroines who are outstanding women, pillars of strength, who have been in the forefront during this century. Some of them are deceased, and a lot of them alive. It would be interesting to pair them with their male counterparts in every arena. You want to talk about education? There's a man here, there's a woman here. You want to talk about fighting for jobs, about health, or any question? There's a woman alongside that, but we seldom hear about her. Now, we could count the numbers of our women who are involved in various campaigns and local projects. We often see the pictures of the men, but their pictures wouldn't be there if the women hadn't been behind that program and being what we used to call Jimmy Higgins. In many of our organizations where a man is president or chairman, women are too often relegated to duties as secretary, fundraiser, oh yes, refreshment provider, and the waitress too. We can be receptionists, the cleanup squad, and maybe a bookkeeper to keep the books, but don't touch the money. Jobs or positions where they're usually seen, but not heard. And rarely do our women, in many of our organizations, I'm talking about black organizations now, in many of them, they do not hold positions as policy and decision makers, even where they constitute the majority of the membership. Male generals, however capable and talented, have no monopoly on ability, nor can they be effective without a mass army, including dedicated women, whose support is too often taken for granted, while the women are being treated as foot soldiers and privates. We are justly concerned about our jeopardized males who are increasingly targeted for attack. But what about the plight of the rising numbers of teenage mothers and single female parents struggling to exist without the male husband or father? Our race cannot survive without both genders, so we should try to instill values to promote their personal concern, commitment, and responsibility to each other. The system, we know, comes down heavy on us, but it cannot be blamed for everything. This brings me back to Malcolm. Maybe some will say that he was not the outstanding opponent of sexism, but I applaud his position on the role of women as respected, equal, and indispensable partners in our everyday struggles to exist and advance. We are aware of some of his transgressions during his youth, and that was reported in his autobiography. But he changed his attitude and lifestyle as he matured. Everybody knows that. I recall Malcolm's reaction when he learned that his mentor, Elijah Muhammad, had violated the ethical principles which Malcolm cherished by an illicit sexual relation with women of his faith. This revelation was traumatic for Malcolm, who was committed for what he considered a terrible indiscretion by a man he truly loved. But I submit that if we take a magnifying glass to all men on the subject of their sexual history and condemn them when they have repented, how many would pass the test and stand 10 feet tall? Now, this is not to condemn promiscuity, but how decisive should be the should this factor be in evaluating a person's legitimacy as a political leader? And I trust we will not be misled or panicked by some recent rumors about Malcolm's sexuality. There have been many charlatans who have resorted to this form of character assassination of several of our other well-known warriors, I don't need to call their names, hoping to create disillusion in our ranks and to portray our heroes as men with clay feet. As we evaluate Malcolm's legacy, let us remember that he died really quite young and had a relatively short period to develop his outlook on the myriad of complex problems we face in an oppressive, exploitative, racist society and in the most powerful country in the world, and where we are numerically a small minority. It's not easy to pull some answers out of our heads as to how all of these things can be addressed. And further, under great pressure and threats of death against his life and that of his family, a situation most of us have never, or maybe I should say not yet, faced. Malcolm never wavered or retreated. But the burden and responsibility has been passed to us to soberly analyze what can be done at this stage of our struggle, concretely and realistically, and not idealistically. There is no simplistic way to forge unity on principles and reach a consensus on a common objective, subordinating minor differences and allowing for a variety of tactics suited to given situations. We, like other races, are not monolithic. There are differences in our class composition and attendant aspirations, experience, age, and political consciousness. And of course, there will always be agents, informers, opportunists, and provocateurs, and those who are silently committed to the status quo, who may attend our meetings or whatever activities are arranged. The baton carried by our genuine freedom fighters over many centuries has been passed to the current generations. And I'm sure that you're motivated to join this long, grueling race to advance many, many more miles to the finishing line. This requires committed, strong, long-distance runners able to withstand the heat, wind and rain, or any other obstacles en route. Beware of detours, siren calls, and slacking up. Adopt a steady stride and keep your eyes on that prize. Now, I would like to conclude, I saw your note. I would like to conclude by thanking you for coming here this weekend. I appreciate the very nice words that were said to me by Abdul about me. But just let me say just two sentences. I am a veteran who's been in the ranks for freedom, justice, equal opportunity, and self-determination for more than half a century. And I'll celebrate my 76th birthday next week. I pledge to keep my fighting boots on for several more years. Your presence has renewed my spirits to to keep the faith that in time we will achieve victory, which will redound to the so-called meek, inferior, impressed, oppressed, and exploited masses all over the globe. Uhuru! Amanda! No justice, no peace. Thank you.